Okay, we'll get started, and I will begin with a very brief prayer that's echoing Wise statement we'll be hearing in a minute. So, mysterious one, help us remember that in your eyes we are all minorities. Amen. So we've been talking about different ways of conceptualizing God, especially among those who are in some way committed to the idea that God and God's self is a mystery, incomprehensible and yet known in various particularities. And we've been thinking about the different symbols people use to think about God and try out in the face of contemporary challenges. Many of these have deep resonances with tradition, and yet when we hear them, they often strike us as quite radical because the implications of some of these theological proposals are sometimes other than what we're used to hearing or contemplating. And so it's fun to hear what's sort of new in these, but also to kind of look back in history and think about what is being appropriated from biblical and historical tradition as well. And we've been thinking about God in sort of universal terms, God as the one mystery above all, the one source of value that animates and gives goodness and validity to other values, but yet relativizes all other values. And therefore have considered thinkers who have thought about God as God as one creator above all, a kind of radically monotheistic perspective. And yet we've been thinking about those who think about God in very particularistic terms, drawing very much on the specificities of experience and cultural location and historical time period, and using symbols drawn from those contexts to think about God in more particular terms. And so today we're going to relate some of these issues to the question of the relation among the world's religions. And I wanted to start out with a quotation from someone who probably many of you have heard of and know well, and knew well, who died a few years ago, the Bishop Christer Stendahl, Bishop of Sweden, and then later leading New Testament scholar and important figure in the American scene and chaplain at Harvard Divinity School. So, where is this from? This is from a talk that actually is called From God's Perspective, We Are All Minorities. And this is when Christer Stendahl held a chair in Jewish-Christian relations at Brandeis University. And I'll just read it aloud. I have found from experience that there is something special about what he's calling multilateral dialogue, one in which we are all minorities, for the simple reason that in so much of religious history, the relation among religions has usually been defined in terms of differences. In other words, one's identity being defined by that which is different from the other. That is so natural to our whole habit of thinking. It is hard for us to conceive a way of defining our identity by that which makes us glad. Multilateral dialogue nurtures that vision that in the eyes of God, we are all minorities. I think a ton is packed into these sentences, and sometimes between two sentences, it seems like there's a thought that's not fully articulated. So I want to invite you to talk with your neighbor about what you see in this quotation real quick before I get on to a little bit of lectury stuff and we'll get back to conversation. Talk with your neighbor. What do you find provocative? What do you like? What do you resonate with? What do you think he means when he opposes difference from being glad? So we were noting that there's a lot of words, a lot of jargon, a lot of abstract terms, and as if you've come to my other classes, you know this is either one of my strengths or weaknesses, that I do think very abstractly, which is probably somewhat annoying. But okay, some of these terms actually Christer Stendahl doesn't really define, but I can venture a definition of, for example, multilateral. Lateral, I imagine, especially if I think of it in the context of a quotation, as various people or faiths or communities or religions occupying a position sort of on the same level, right, the same latitude, right? So there's not one that's presumed to be above the other, okay? And then multi meaning many. So many coming together in their particularities, seeing their genuine particularities or differences or the constitutive stuff that makes them who they are, what they are. And many of those coming together in a relationship that's on the same plane and sharing from those particular positions. Does that make sense? I mean, again, I'm kind of risking a definition because in this whole article, which I read. He doesn't actually define it, and probably there's not one definition, but yeah.
It seems to me this whole thing, the key issue is, what does he mean by glad?
I know. That's where I think the train of thought, there's a gap in the train of thought.
It's hard for us to see a way of defining our identity by that which makes us glad. Okay, the thing is, he's saying normally, normatively, look at our identity in terms of differences. Okay, well, I expected him to say, define our identity by essentially things we share in common.
Uh-huh.
But he says it makes us glad. So what does that mean? Things that are in accord with our underlying most basic sense of values, our aesthetics, whatever else, things we recognize as important to us. But the issue is, given cultural differences, those things are going to be somewhat different, at least different in emphasis between different groups. So therefore, it's very hard for me to see what he's really getting at by his statement about that which makes us glad.
Good. And he does elaborate on this a little bit later in the article, but you had a thought you were about to share.
I was just going to say that I kind of took that to be the norm being that we have a defensive.
Good. Okay.
And that we operate out of a sense of fear and threat when we're operating with other, again, you know, defending ourselves against others.
Right. So maybe he's relating this to, I mean, I think there's lots of things going on. And when he gave this talk, as he probably was when he was young, but he was also old, he was very, very, very wise and full of millions of thoughts and had read millions of books and was kind of speaking extemporaneously, so you get these nuggets of wisdom. But at the end, but you know, having a whole career behind him, he doesn't always complete the thoughts. So I think it's right, if we see gaps in the train of thought there, it's because he's going to elaborate on them later, or he's just sort of has the privilege of being an incredibly wise, smart guy who's going to, you know, make it make sense later. But I think one of the things we can think about is he seems to be talking about an attitude that people can sometimes have about truth. That if one thing is true, and then someone else thinks another thing is true, those have to be clashing somehow. If you think of truth as a cognitive proposition, a propositional statement, right? And then it either is valid or not valid. And then if someone says something else, it's a propositional statement that contradicts this one over here, those have to be clashing and different somehow. So there has to be a defensiveness there. I like that word, that sometimes people approach difference, especially with respect to religious truth, with a kind of defensiveness, that if I'm going to embrace with full conviction my own truth, and then it comes into conflict with someone else's, then that's going to reveal our differences, and we're going to think about our differences and kind of divide ourselves. Does anyone have a thought about what he meant by glad? Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, or just was wondering, is if the experience that I have of that being glad, where the starting, if we start from that experience of what was the most joyous about what we believe, about this tradition, this experience, what really was at the heart of it that made, right, where you feel sense of connectedness, sense of being heard, value, and started from that point, rather than how might we be different. So that,
right.
And the emotional connection, the sense of
good
largerness, the place where we could stand together.
Good.
And those other things are more the description of the larger.
Good. One thing he says, a refrain in this article later, which he says in other talks as well, is he's trying to address the question, how can I sing my song to Jesus with abandon without telling negative stories about others, right, who have songs that they love to sing with abandon that are different from mine and that might have the same potentially universal implications that they hold dear in their hearts, right? So how can I sing that song of gladness with great gladness and hear someone else sing their song of gladness with great gladness that they think might have a scope that's extensive with God's creation, right? And not see that as a clash, as difference, as something that gets defensive, right? So I think he's trying to say, well, let's celebrate our particularities and bring those to the table when we're in conversation and see where we go from there. Again, not presuming that one person's gladness has to be above or more true or ultimately overrule or subsume another person's gladness. And I think he's trying to say, look, there are streams or trends or urges within the diverse history of Christian theology that would want us to say that, for example, Christ's salvation has universal significance, that the whole world will be saved through Christ, or the whole world will be saved through Jesus, right? Well, how do you square that universal scope of salvation through Christ with the heartfelt songs of others who are singing a different song with abandon to something else? Okay, so I don't think it's not an easy dilemma to solve that he's pointing to here. Okay, so he says there are a couple of approaches, and we're going to talk about some of these when we think about a particular thinker's model for religious pluralism, that he thinks are kind of well-meaning approaches to thinking about religious difference, but ultimately are dead ends. And one is the kind of what he calls the common denominator approach. So when you encounter religious difference, you say, well, but in the end, all religions say this, or all religions say that. Well, in the end, the essence of all religions is love, or in the end, the essence of all religions is justice, or in the end, all religions are trying to tell us to do this. So then you're kind of pushing particularity or radical particularity under the rug, or pushing it aside.
Right? Devaluing it.
Right, devaluing the robustness of people's true, colorful identities. And saying, well, you're really just like me. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have to grapple with the different kinds of insights that we get from each other or the different presumptions that we bring to the table. Another pitfall, he thinks, is a certain kind of attitude of tolerance. Okay. Does anyone have a sense as to why tolerance as a response to religious pluralism might intellectually be a dead end? Of course, tolerance means 10 million different things. But can you imagine, like, have a gut feeling what he's thinking about here? Yeah.
It assumes that somehow I am above, and if we're gracious, they will let you in.
That is exactly what he says. He says it has an elitist lining sometimes. Of course, tolerance has been an incredibly important political value in various contexts in the history of Europe, but in a certain way within religious pluralism, sometimes there's a sense of, he says, that. First of all, tolerance sometimes comes with a certain kind of detachment. Well, it's not really that important to me, so everyone can think what they want to think. Kind of a lazy relativism, right? Or it can be this thing like, well, I can't really expect others to know what I know, and so I'm tolerant of what all those other people believe because, I sort of am a little bit more, whatever, educated or sort of, sophisticated, and so I can just let them be who they are, but I kind of know that if they were like me, they'd be tolerant too. Yeah.
One of the issues tolerance is that it can reflect massive indifference.
Yes.
And devaluing of everything. Mm-hmm. Essentially, in the extreme case, it ends up saying nothing matters. Nothing is of importance.
Good.
Enough to get fired up about.
Right, and this person that I'm going to talk about a little bit today, after talking about a few others, named S. Markheim, who teaches at Andover Newton Theological Seminary in the Boston area, wrote Salvation's Truth and Difference in Religion. He has lots of kind of what he calls a job description for a better Christian pluralistic theology. And one of the things he says is that I want there to be genuine risk. He says all sorts of other things. I mean, genuine commitment, but genuine risk in our statements or our theologies of religious pluralism. I don't want it to be just indifference, like, well, if you're true, it's fine. If I'm true, because we're all going to the same place, even though we don't know it, and you do it your way, I do it my way. Because basically, then no one can be wrong, but no one can be particularly right. But in the end, there's not much at stake. He wants religious faith and commitment to be, to be a risk. There's something at stake in it, or maybe also that it's a risk, not just that you might be wrong or someone else might be wrong, but that you might actually genuinely adjust your perspective when you hear someone else's. Right? If everyone's equally right and equally wrong, then who cares? Why have dialogue? Right? Then there's nothing you could learn, nothing you could change, nothing you could help someone else see. Not that we all want to then become each other. But yeah, this idea of risk. He thinks that a lot of liberal pluralistic theologies have gotten rid of the idea of risk. Because nothing matters, as you say. It's kind of a lazy relativism. Okay. All right. Great. So, I think I'm going to present just briefly a typology that probably some of you have seen before, which is a typical way of indicating three different ways that people see Christianity, or Christian thinkers, or Christian people have viewed other religions in the history of Christianity. So if this is familiar to you, maybe that's good or maybe it's bad. So Christian attitudes toward other religions, people have developed in recent decades what they call a typology, so three different types or styles of thinking about the relationship between Christianity and other religions. Who's seen this before? Exclusivism, inclusivism, pluralism. Okay, so not being too redundant. Okay, good. So one of the things that one of the thinkers I'm gonna share with you, we're gonna look at a couple of quotations by him, says he's really worried about this typology for all sorts of reasons. And he thinks this just kind of gets us up on the wrong starting point or on the wrong foot when we try to think about a Christian theology of religions, which is the name that theologians often give to theological reflection done from within Christian tradition about the place of Christianity among the world religions. Okay, so the first one is that is sort of, each of these has their place in Christian tradition, right? Have echoes from different historical periods. I don't think we should think that, like, this one came first, then there was that one, and then there was this one, because that's kind of a model of progress, where as we go forward in future, we're all getting better and we're getting smarter, right? There's a lot of wisdom about pluralism right from the beginning, and there's a lot of debate and diversity right from the beginning, right? Okay, so exclusivism would be the idea that outside the church or apart from faith in Jesus Christ, whether one has a more institutional or more personal perspective, there's no salvation. So this idea, so this would be echoing Cyprian, early Christian bishop, who says, outside the church, no salvation. Of course, he wasn't thinking about religious pluralism or interreligious dialogue. So the idea that Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation, and that people in other religions do not attain salvation. Okay, so inclusivism, then, is the idea that people in other religions are saved through the all-encompassing grace of Christ. So there's a sense in which Christ's grace is so compassionate, efficacious, universal, that even if people in other communities or people who aren't religious at all don't know it, they're saved by the grace of Christ, which is ultimately bringing them to salvation with the Godhead or with God. Okay, so here Jesus Christ is still the only way to salvation, right? But again, especially, what's the right word? Kind of wise, righteous, well-meaning, moral people in other communities who are sort of doing similar acts of compassion and justice and faithful ways of living are also encompassed through the grace of Christ. Okay, this became popular around Vatican II. I mean, it also has other expressions again earlier in the history of Christianity. But this word inclusivism came from the idea, which at the time was incredibly forward-thinking and controversial, by Karl Rahner, a Catholic theologian important during Vatican II, who came up with the idea of anonymous Christians. So calling the institutional church to be more open-minded about religions outside of Christianity and about ways of life outside of Christianity, models of salvation, said, well, let's think of heartfelt people of faith in other religions as anonymous Christians, right? They have their own ways. They have their way is holy as well. And we can see that even if they have no regard for Christianity or don't know what's going on in Christianity, that they too are saved by the grace of Christ. So his intention was to be humble in some ways. But of course, the very phrase has a horribly imperialistic sound to it, yes, right? Even if you say why.
Why? Well,
yeah.
It suggests that those others are less than, or they're lower in importance. And that they'll find their way somehow, or we are here to help them find their way in terms of to Christianity. So it's oppressive language.
Okay.
Or it doesn't matter what they think. They're all completely wrong-headed. But
right.
We have the truth, and our truth is so big it can include their ignorance.
Right. Good, exactly. So it may be that we're going to kind of bring them to us. But it also could be, even if they die never having known of me or ever having cared to become me, they still are me. Right? But they don't know it.
They can't.
So it's very presumptuous.
Right?
Say it again.
They can't establish their own identity.
Right.
They have no right to their own identity.
once again, it has no regard for the particularity and the value of the particularity, the particular identity of another person, in some sense. Okay. And then pluralism is a term, a pluralistic theology is, this language is certainly much more recent among a number of theologians who think of that different religions are different paths to the same place. So in some sense, this echoes a slogan that became very important for other completely different reasons. For example, in the work of Gandhi, who says that religions are different roads converging to the same point. Right? But when Christian theologians appropriate this, they use this to come up with a liberal theology of pluralism, in which there's a idea that that no one really knows the mysterious one who is God, but each religion, because of its own cultural, social, historical context, comes up with different symbols or receives different revelations about who this God is through their own experience and through their traditions and their scriptures. And ultimately, all of those particularities remain particular, but they're ultimately pointing to the same truth that is beyond our knowledge, okay? But that we're all going to the same place. Okay, so what, say more. That one is troubling because...
I find it really troubling because in some ways it's only a minor shift from the inclusivism type of position.
Yep.
And it's making an assumption that in fact these different religions are in fact oriented to the same place.
Good.
It seems to me there's other ways of looking at this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That you get from people who, being true to their own tradition, have immersed themselves in the life of another tradition, mm-hmm. and that can speak to the validity of that tradition as reflecting human experience mm-hmm. and aspiration in that particular context. Mm-hmm. But that's a quite different thing than really saying that they're all, mm-hmm. that deep down inside, they're all the same.
Right. Okay. So good. So this is there are a couple of things that Markheim thinks is just wrong-headed about this typology. Okay, so one of the things is that he says that, you know, okay, it's nice to kind of step aside and sort of see all the problems with each one of these options. But really, all religions in some ways at certain moments, I don't mean in time, but with respect to certain issues, may be descriptively each one of these. Right? I mean, as a religious person, there may be aspects, or as a religious community, there may be aspects of thought or theology or ways of being that you'd want to have an exclusivist attitude towards. So, for example, first of all, there may be certain things that one would want to reject. Right? And secondly, if one takes plurality radically seriously, then you would say, well, yeah, Jesus Christ is the only way to Christian salvation. Actually, that's true. And I don't think that would really bother someone who's not a Christian, because maybe they're not going for Christian salvation. Right? So in some sense, it's just sort of a truism that Jesus Christ is the only way to the salvation that Christians talk about. Of course, there's a diversity of opinion among Christians about that too. But that's about diversity within a tradition, not among. And there's nothing horribly, completely wrong about inclusivism. There may be moments in which within a tradition I want to say, well, you know, with respect to these kinds of gestures or sensibilities, mm-hmm. these two religions have something in common. Mm-hmm. You know, this stream of that tradition is a little bit like this stream of my tradition. And I think we are kind of mm-hmm. saying something similar and converging in a similar way with respect to that aspect of the life of faith. So there may be aspects in which it's valid to be an inclusivist, right? And there may be certainly ways in which all religions are descriptively pluralist, again, insofar as they see the genuine difference among religions, okay? And see those as there being a valid and genuine plurality among the religions. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that one religion could require at different moments each of these judgments. Okay, so the second point, though, is that each of these stances sees salvation as one single reality. Okay, none of these stances sees the religions as maybe pursuing different ends. Okay, so for each of these, there's only one religious end, and there's only one religious fulfillment, right? And exclusivism, that's obvious, right? Outside the church, no salvation, apart from Jesus Christ, no salvation, right? In inclusivism, there's only one religious end, right? The anonymous Christian, everyone saved by the universal grace of Christ. There's only one religious fulfillment, and that's why Haim calls his book Salvations. He uses the word salvation for a religious end or fulfillment, a goal, right? Maybe there are many goals. Maybe there are many salvations, plural. Okay, and even in pluralism, there's only one religious end and one religious fulfillment, because all the different religions in their differentness are leading toward the same end. Okay, so salvation is one religion. So in each of these, then, particularity is in some way insignificant. Okay. So the dogmatic pluralist would say the particularities of all religions are insignificant, as we've mentioned. Okay, that it doesn't really matter that we're all different because we're all going to the same place. Okay. And for example, in the exclusivist, the particularities of all religions except mine are insignificant. Okay. And same probably with inclusivists. Okay. But so there's a disregard for this, again, for this word particularity that people see. So I have a little handout which gives you an example, though, of a pluralistic theology that is common, and that actually, even though Mark Haim is reacting against this pluralistic theology, this typical model of pluralism might resonate with some of us in the room, and I'd love to hear about that. But I'm going to give, I have two drawings. Because it's hard for me to use the PowerPoint and use the whiteboard, although I'll do that a little bit later, I hope. So this is double-sided, but just look at the side that says Hick's model of the religions. Okay? And the other side will have Haim's. And I'm not sure that we'll get through everything today, but that's okay, because I have a plan for how to do it. And I'm sure we'll be okay. I don't think I made enough copies. Let's people feel that there's nothing to agree. At least people feel okay sharing. Page 20. It's all a visual. What do you think? Is there enough to? I think I have my own. Yes.
Anybody without?
Oh, by the way.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I forgot that I did write down who we were talking about. We've been talking about universalism and particularism, and also universality and particularity. And Chris Restendel refers, this is just a little segue here, to these terms, and talks about universalism as being a great danger within the history of Christian theology and Christian thought. And by that he means the idea that there's one truth that extends across the world that is true for all, apart from contingencies or particularities. Okay, so one truth that's kind of coextensive with all of creation. And then particularism would be there's some kind of non-universal particular revelation, right? A truth that is true for a particular people, important to them, having full, robust validity, but not claiming to be the whole. Okay? So I'm going to come back to this a little bit later. Because you can see how, even though here, the definitions that I've come up with and putting them in light of the things we've been talking about, probably universalism would be the one that we're supposed to look negatively on. But I think there are significant universal moments that one finds oneself grappling with if one, again, confesses the first article of the Creed, for example. If God is the creator of the whole world, then it's hard to avoid sometimes thinking of truth or God's purpose, as extending across the whole world. So it's not that one's bad, but problematic in terms of its uses and its implications sometimes. Okay, so, my notes here. So one model, I hope, I know that we all are different kinds of learners, and I've been doing some just lecture and some, yesterday we did more discussion with quotations, and here we're doing a little visual learning, so I hope these little charts aren't too confusing and maybe perhaps helpful. But this, the third option for the typology, pluralism, is a kind of theology that a theologian named John Hick, who some of you have probably heard of, has been also been writing for probably four decades, developed a pluralistic theology. And in his view, all religions are different orientations on the one transcendent real. Okay, so here you have in my picture the real. That could be akin to God. So that one transcendent, mysterious real that is beyond our capacity to know with utmost certainty or directness. Okay? That's the mystery beyond the capacities of human knowledge, but toward which we're directed when we're in the business of being religious or faithful. Okay? So there's that one transcendent real that reveals itself or is experienced in a diversity of ways among different cultures and contexts and peoples and communities and religions. Okay. And so each of those, and those different religions or communities over the course of time, through their sacred scriptures, through their blendings with other cultures, through their writings, through their practices, come up with symbols. And those symbols that become symbols of that real, okay, and not only represent this transcendent, but also propose and apply certain kind of life ways that people are called to as part of their spirituality and practice. Okay? And so all of these different religions, including a religion that we might not think of as a kind of historical religion, like, for example, an ideology, I don't mean ideology at all in a negative way at all, but like secular humanism, or you might even think that Marxism or something, these could be thought of as religions, or I guess in different type or life ways, right? That these are all converging on the same, different ways of pointing to that same real. Okay. And so, and they're all seeking in some way a certain kind of salvation, even though they name it differently that is similar. So in the middle of my circle here, I have salvation would be, instead of being self-centered, one turns toward a reality-centered. So a centeredness toward others or a centeredness toward that transcendent real. Okay. And insofar as our religions call us out of that, right, being turned inward in oneself, into oneself or in oneself, which is what one of the way Augustine defines sin in Christian, right, turned in on oneself, we turn toward the other, taking us away from sin and toward salvation. The religions are doing that in each in their own way. Okay. With dramatically different ways of symbolizing that and doing that. And of course, each religion is internally diverse. So there are aspects of, for example, he thinks Christianity that aren't actually pointing toward the real because the way that they invest these symbols of authority ends up being too self-centered and not enough other-centered. So here, let's look at the chart to see what he means by this. So there's the real that's on the outside circle that no one really knows. Okay? Then there's that salvation that everyone's aiming for. And then there are these different religions that I have in circles on the bottom. Okay. And they each have their different ways of their fulfillments, seeking nirvana for the Buddhist, right? Maybe for a secular humanist, ethical behavior, living in humanistic, ethical sort of ways. And for Christianity, obviously there are lots of options. Christianity is not the only one that's diverse, but I wanted to represent the diversity of Christian ways of defining salvation. So out of Christianity, we've got, well, some Christians see salvation as following Jesus as the Son of God. And that's in quotation marks. So they see that Son of God as a metaphor, not the only way of describing the transcendent. Okay? Then there are other Christians who are exclusivist in the sense that they really see themselves as following Jesus as the one true revelation of God. But their behavior is still other-centered, right? And centered toward God, that they sort of passed this test of being a valid religion in terms of their ethical stance. So they may believe robustly that Jesus is the only way to salvation in a more
sort of literal way than the first strand I have coming out does. But they're not condemning of others, or they're not imposing it on others, and they're still having a sufficient kind of humility that orients them toward that transcendent, mysterious, real, and toward compassion for others. Okay. But a kind of exclusivism about Jesus Christ, plus what he's calling unjust behavior, would not pass this test, which I've listed at the bottom. So this is my one-page picture of John Hick's really thick book. It's actually 450 pages. Okay, so which is why I can see that we're probably going to continue this in a way that's accessible to all next time. So how do I avoid just being a lazy relativist and saying, well, all religions are true because they're all going to the same crap, he says. They're all different paths to the same place. He says, well, no, I have a test. And that's what I call the soteriological criterion. There's another one of those words. Soteriology, talk about salvation. Mm-hmm. A model of salvation, not soteriology. Okay? So it means a theory of salvation. So his criterion, his test for whether a religion is salvific is, are the participants in that religion advancing toward self-sacrificing concern for the good of others? Okay, yes?
So, over on the secular humanist one, mm-hmm. and the ethical behavior.
Oh, thank you.
Wouldn't they just say, well, just go straight for the ethical behavior. Skip all this.
Awesome, yeah.
Mumbo jumbo over here,
yeah.
It gets us in trouble.
Good. Responses? Thanks, because I forgot to mention that. Why I wrote the chart that way. There's a right angle turn, right? Or maybe it's not totally right angle. So the other three of the arrows think they're going to salvation, and they are, right? The four Christians who are exclusivists and unjust, unfortunately, they're not going there according to this model, right? Okay, so this shows you even the liberal pluralist is exclusivist. He doesn't actually think that Christians like that are passing the soteriological test. So once if we thought he was a good liberal who kind of accepted everyone, well, he doesn't, right? And is that bad? Well, not necessarily, because we said we want religion to be a risk. We want us to be able to disagree with and reject certain propositions. Mm-hmm. It depends on kind of the attitude one has, I guess, or I don't know.
Seems like in terms of this whole soteriological, I mean, it's still very exclusive thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we could say, like, I could talk to these people because I kind of get they have this path to go in someplace, but what even just like Judaism, mm-hmm. where I don't think that's really about salvation per se. A lot of people frame it as like a homecoming or mm-hmm. something, and it's also that there's this sort of within that there's sort of ambiguity of like, well, there's a universal God, but we're special, mm-hmm. you know, we have this particular revelation and responsibility, and so mm-hmm. it's like, where does that fit on this chart, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I could, you know, and so, I mean, because Buddhism, we can sort of see that as like, well, it's kind of analogous to. But is Buddhism even a religion? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that says I can't practice some sort of meditation that is mm-hmm. transcendental or whatever, mm-hmm. and still be, you know, there's nothing that's inherently in conflict with any of this mm-hmm. Christianity stuff, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good. I think the objections and the good points that I'm hearing can be kind of brought together in the observation that this is sort of an inclusivist theology as well, based on our typology, right? We've seen that it's exclusivist. We're not sure whether that's good or bad, maybe, and that it doesn't allow Christians who aren't liberals. Whoops, that's fine. Christians who aren't liberals to be really part of salvation, right? In some sense, and John Hick is a liberal pluralist theologian. I'm not using liberal in a good or bad way, but also. With respect to the right angle thing about the secular humanists, right? So this perspective says, well, secular humanists don't think they're going toward the transcendental. I mean, who knows? I'm sure every secular humanist is different from every other one, whatever. But in general, one can imagine a humanist saying, no, I'm not really interested in, thank you very much, but no thanks. I'm not interested in saying that my path is leading to the same God that yours, because I don't think it is. I just want my path to be going straight. I don't want it to make that right angle turn that you just made me make. In your inclusivist imperialist objection. So this is also a form of inclusivism. But the thing is that pluralist theologians, according to Mark Keim, are really committed to not being exclusivist and not being inclusivist in some ways, right? Because they think those are bad. But then when we look at this model, Keim wants to say, and we don't have to agree with Keim. I'm kind of taking his position right now, and not this is which Taylor that I kind of
believe everything he's saying either, but this does show the ways in which there's a kind of presumptuousness here in this model of pluralistic theology, right? That secular humanists are going there even if they don't want to, right?
Unless they're unjust in this case.
In which case they're not, right? Exactly. Saying that the, I think we can be too hard on him sometimes. I don't think that one has to not recognize that there are radical differences in the practices and life ways of religious traditions and in their words and in their actions and in their liturgies. I don't think one has to ignore that to sort of apply this. I think one can say, well, yeah, these are genuinely different, but they're all in their own way trying to get at something that none of us knows. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of right, and it's sort of wrong if you're being really critical, but there's something, it doesn't have to disregard particularity completely. Yeah.
This just feels very individualistic to me. The whole concept of the salvation here is a personal thing, and even self-sacrificing concern for the good of others. And so I think of Judaism, which is much more communally based, and I'm thinking of where are we talking about healing a broken world and corporateness in all of this.
Okay, good. Yeah. And there have been some theologians, for example, Paul Knitter, who was actually spelled K-N-I-T-T-E-R, like Sonia or Knitter, a Catholic theologian who has kind of taken that approach. I think he's got lots of books out. One might be called One Earth, Many Religions or something. But he approaches a pluralistic theology by recognizing the genuine differences among religions but asking sort of how we can see the ways in which at certain moments religious communities come together to work for justice. And that's where they can join hands. Mm-hmm. We don't have to, we don't have to kind of say that we're all saying the same thing. We don't have to say that there's one truth, one doctrine, or one dogmatic proposition that's more true than that one. But we can say that each religion has its own resources, which are different, but that help us all work together for a more just earth, right, and a conception of justice. Haim worries that then we're subsuming everything under a certain notion of justice. He's like, well, okay, fine, but not every strand of every religion, cares the most about a certain kind of justice, again, defined in certain social justice sort of liberal terms. He wants to really, really push people to really respect and engage genuine difference in some sense, even ideological difference with respect to social justice issues. But he has a lot of affinities with this perspective.
I'm struck by the irony that he named his book Salvations as if all of these things are going towards something that they would agree is some kind of salvation. It seems like Haim's doing the same thing.
Good.
Fundamentally, he thinks there is something like this, and it's called salvation in his mind.
Sort of. We'll look at this picture, but that's a good point. He likes to use the word in the actual book fulfillments or ends, like a telos, right? Like religious ends toward which one, like the end, but toward which an arc is sort of moving or something. But I think maybe he thought that salvations was more provocative or made a better title or something. Fulfillments or ends might. Right? So, but that's a good point. Is by using the very word salvation, is that again presuming too much about similarity or something? So, good. Okay, so what Mark Haim does, that was serendipitous. Well, I don't know that I'm going to take us to the answer. I'm kind of going to make a little spontaneous executive decision about whether I might adjust one of my other sessions on Friday to come back to this in a new way. So some of the things that Mark Haim offers as a criticism, which we've echoed in our reflections here, is that, again, pluralistic theologies, akin to those like Mark Haim, they're culturally particular, he thinks, without admitting it. Okay, it's not wrong to have a theology that's rooted in a particular cultural identity or that's rooted in a particular political or ideological set of commitments. But pluralistic theologies kind of strive to be generic enough that they can kind of include everyone, or neutral, right? And he says, no, this theology actually reflects very nicely a kind of liberal Christian theology of a certain flavor. And yet, so it has that particularity, but it doesn't admit that it has that particularity. And also has a strong strong, unstated religious and ethical or normative motivation. Again, the neutrality claim is what Heim is worried about in theologies like Hicks that we saw the picture of, right? Because this has a strong motivation, a religious motivation, to sort of say that all religions should be this way and should have these ethical and normative commitments, right? And should not make the kind of exclusivist statements that we might hear among what we sometimes call more conservative branches of Christianity or whatever, right? So therefore, they're also exclusive, as we noted, without admitting it, okay? And they don't give enough importance to particularity, because they seem to say, again, all things are going to the same, all paths are going to the same place. And importantly, religions don't necessarily have to learn from each other in this model. Do you know why he would say that? I mean, I have a lot of nodding, so maybe it's obvious. And do you think it's true? I mean, I'm not sure. I think I'm being too hard on it.
We can all get there on one path.
Okay. So therefore,
I mean, they could be separate paths, but you don't have to go over and look at the secular humanist path. The secular humanist doesn't have to look at the Christian paths, or they're mutually exclusive.
Okay, good. Was there a half a hand up back here? No? Okay. So one might ask then, what's the point of interreligious dialogue? Right? Or what's the point, what can one really gain from kind of conversation or friendship, across religious lines or something? And so Heim wants to, so the point with Heim, I think, is, look, it's not bad to be an exclusivist. It's not bad to be an inclusivist. It's not necessarily bad to be a pluralist. But he says, I think it's bad to be those things and not admit that you're those things. Mm-hmm. Right? Why are you claiming neutrality, or that you have a generic theory of religions? Right? That's what bothers me, because it's a hidden inclusivism. And that's what seems to be dangerous or imperialistic, right? You're imposing something that seems to be normative on all others, right? But you're not even admitting that you're doing it. And so there's a certain kind of ignorance that goes along with the potential implications of what you're saying. Okay, so I think he's got a really interesting and provocative critique. Let's see, is this going to work? Let's see. If not, it's okay. Let's see. Let that warm up. All right, so here's his job description for a better pluralistic theology, and then I'm going to show you, which you don't have on your chart, I'm going to draw it on the whiteboard, so maybe I don't need the projector. Heim comes up with two different, I drew pictures of two different moments in his proposal. And one is his kind of generic model of what he means by multiple salvations or multiple ends or fulfillments. And another is how he would say that from a heartfelt Christian theological perspective. Okay? So there's kind of the generic moment where he's giving you kind of a theory of the religions. And then there's a rooted in Christian confessional theology moment where he's saying that. Okay, so, but first, here's his job description for a better pluralistic theology. Okay, so first of all, one, don't claim neutrality. Okay, number two, engage religions on their own terms.
Yep.
Don't subsume them into your identity. Okay, have a clear purpose for interreligious dialogue so that, people can learn from each other, like we were just talking about over here. Be open, he says, to multiple religious fulfillments. Hicks' picture, all religions converge, right? What if they didn't converge? Can we just let that be? Now, how does that square, though, with a monotheistic God? I'm not sure. But I'll show you. Right, that's God's problem. I'll show you how he thinks it does. So don't disallow uniqueness claims. Okay, so don't disallow the certain kind of Christian exclusivist that Hick kind of disallows in some ways. Right? Although he's only because of their bad behavior, he says. But anyway. But try simultaneously, try to allow people to again, sing their song, as he would say, as First Sinel said, sing their song to Jesus or to whoever with abandon, right? And say that this really is a unique thing, right? And it's not the same as something else. And it gives truth that something else doesn't give. Right? Allow those uniqueness claims.
this is something that my community uniquely offers, right? That is good, and that is perhaps even a mission, right? And that may also therefore reject other alternatives. Don't disallow those kinds of claims. On the other hand, allow some religious positions to be wrong. So again, let there be genuine risk. Let there be also the courage of convictions. And let in yourself the capacity for you to be wrong. So, and then think about in this moment here that it's Janine, right? Is it?
Yes. Okay.
This moment that you talked about. Think about the relation between religions and social justice. So he wants to relate. Well, as I'm thinking about this theology of religious pluralism, I want to also address the issue of kind of religious violence and conflict among religions in our world, and the ways in which religions can help serve sort of earth concerns and et cetera. So think about social justice issues as you're thinking about religious pluralism and your model of theology. And then, finally, ground your proposal in Christian theology. Right? Show me how this is really relying on, leaning on, retrieving from your tradition, from scripture, from tradition, from the insights, from the liturgies, from the practices. Okay? So tell me where you get that from Christian theology. Okay. All right, so I'll give you a preview, and then we'll come back to this. I'll talk with Sonia and Tristan whether I should do this tomorrow or the next day, but I can find a way to do it so that even if people aren't here today, we can consider Haim's constructive proposal without knowing everything that he rejects next time. Okay, I want to turn that off. Okay. So here is the beginning of Haim's generic picture. This a generic theory of the relation among the world religions, I guess. I'm not sure I said that exactly right, but his theory of how we could think about religions if we didn't think they were converging on the same path. Okay, thank you. Yeah, no, I'll be tripping in one of the right. Okay. So on this, R means religion, and F means fulfillment or salvation, okay? So he's not using the word salvation here, because this is his generic theory, right? As a theorist of religion, maybe, not as a Christian theologian, although he doesn't think one can really divest one of one's identity in that way. Let's make these to be fun, blue or turquoise, and this to be dark blue. I don't know. Okay, never mind. I did that just because I thought it was fun to have lots of color. Okay, so we've got religion A. We don't know what that religion is, right? We've got religion B. Did I do that right? Yeah. We've got religion C, religion D, and religion E. We'll put circles around these so you can see. So there they are. Now they're all going to their own fulfillments. But we're not just going to go like this. Straight arrow, straight arrow, straight arrow, straight arrow, straight arrow. We're not going to do that. Okay. Instead, so we'll say religion A is going to fulfillment A. Okay, so religion A is aiming toward a fulfillment that is unique that it gets because it's A. There's A in both of them, right? And it's meeting it, right? Religion B and religion C, it turns out, might be aiming toward the same thing. So some fulfillments might converge. Some religions might converge. Or, in some cases, he wants to allow for the possibility that one religion could potentially supersede another. Okay. So both B and C are going to fulfillment C. Possibility. Okay. Religion D is going somewhere, but we don't actually know. It might be going nowhere. It might be wrong. Or it might be
know, getting to a higher height that, I don't know, that it might just be reaching mystery even more profoundly or something, right? Or a fulfillment that, right? And then religion E is going to a fulfillment. But I didn't draw this very well, except for you can see that A and E have something in common, right? They each are a religion proclaiming a certain salvation, and they're reaching that salvation. I know this sounds really weird because we're talking in these broad terms, but do you see anything slightly different in how I drew it?
A is higher.
So one could say that I mean, if one were a member of this religion, one could acknowledge that religion E has an admirable fulfillment, and that religion E reaches an admirable fulfillment. But it's not as abiding or as valuable or as sustaining as mine.
So you could also say it's closer.
Right? What?
It's closer.
More achievable.
And more achievable.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I know, I don't like this horizontal way I've done this, because it still makes it seem like it's this otherworldly goal or something like that, and that the higher you are, the better you are, or something like that. But you can see that, this differs from Hicks in lots of ways, right? Not all religions are converging on the same path, right? It recognized genuine difference, right? And it recognizes that some, you might not know about the status of another religion, or you might think it's wrong, right? You might actually admire another religion, but think that it's sort of less ultimate than the God that you pray to, or whatever.
So I'm struggling with that.
Yeah.
According to what criteria or what worldview can you decide how high or how lofty these things are?
Okay,
so it seems
good.
Like in order to evaluate our E, you'd mm-hmm. be using the values of FA mm-hmm. and compare it. So like is this truly a relativistic thing, in which case you have no basis of comparison?
Good question. Does anyone have an answer or a thinking out loud thought in response to that?
It's never not without bias. It's
okay.
Always with bias because we're human.
Good.
And we apply our own set of values
okay.
to that model.
Right. So I think Heim would say, even though he might have confused us by giving us this generic theory, actually I agree there's no way that one could be neutral about this.
Mm-hmm.
There is no criterion that could apply to all these. The only way you could say that is to be situated in one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so religion C, you know, might recognize that religion A is different and valid and meets its religious fulfillment, but might think that it encompasses religion B. I don't know. Or not even that it supersedes, maybe just it just genuinely thinks that through cultural, it could be like this even, that through the kind of contingencies of history and culture and the ways in which religions always take on local expressions and are born in local expressions, that religions change and adopt and overlap and syncretize with each other, that two religions do end up going to a similar path because they end up having a shared history and cultural location. Yeah?
There's another related problem here, and that is that different religions, if you look at how they see themselves, what they're doing, they're responding to different core issues
mm-hmm.
to some extent. With Christianity,
mm-hmm.
You know, from a Christian perspective, the problem is sin, and the answer is salvation through Jesus Christ. Okay? For a Muslim, the deep
mm-hmm.
problem is pride,
mm-hmm.
and the solution is submission to the will of God.
So you're saying
it's not that Christians don't see
uh-huh.
that pride is an issue,
right?
And it's not that Muslims
yeah.
don't recognize that sin is an
right.
issue. But it's where is the primary
right.
emphasis?
Okay, good. Well, let's.
And for Buddhists, the primary problem is suffering.
Okay. Yeah.
And the answer is transcendence of suffering.
Right. So for the sake of time, though, let's think about. And I wanted to talk about, when we talk about his own, I'm going to take back the handouts, by the way, because we'll look at those. I wanted to talk one day about the implications of some of these theologies for a model of faith. So let's look at specifically Hicks' model of faith, and we'll look at his
Christian theologically rooted proposal for how to think about world religions. And that's where we start to answer some of these questions. And that's where we can continue this. And it won't be predicated on knowing this. We can think about what is his theology, his spirituality, his faith perspective, and how a Christian theologically rooted can think about the relation among religions and addresses some of these questions. But I think the question is, does this chart make room for seeing the genuine difference and having genuine admiration for a different path, even though you know it's not yours, right? So there's some possibilities here that could be developed. And if you peek in the back, you see that Heim tries to develop a Trinitarian theology that ends up encompassing all these ends but not collapsing them or making them the same. I can't take the question because of time, but I'd love to talk with you now after class. So questions, welcome up front, and the conversation will continue. I'm not sure whether we'll continue. I'll talk with Sonia either tomorrow or Friday. If we'll just stick with tomorrow's topic, or we'll just kind of do part B on Friday as kind of a wrap-up and thinking about faith and particularity and universality.
How many people that are here today will be gone on Friday? How many people will you be here tomorrow?
Sorry, I hope I
didn't
cause a problem.
No, not at all. Just put it in our case. I just wanted to take a little poll.
Awesome. All right. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.